Special Sauce is brought to you by Soyve. Unlock the awesome with marinades like Very Very Teriyaki and Hoisin Garlic.
Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I grew up with a huge crush on Geordie LaForge, so I think I...
Geordie LaForge?
The chief engineer of the USS Enterprise in CC-1701D, Ed. Gosh.
This week, our guest is the newest addition to the Serious Eats culinary team, pastry chef extraordinaire and sweets guru Stella Parks.
Next thing you know, I'm going to be like selling artisanal sugar down at the farmer's market.
To me, this is
hand-roasted.
Like, this is mad genius material that is deserving of a MacArthur Award. I first discovered Stella's brilliance reading her perfectly titled blog, Brave Tart. When she launched that blog in 2011, Stella was the pastry chef at a restaurant in Lexington, Kentucky, where she grew up. Word of her mad genius quickly spread, and in 2013, Food & Wine magazine named her one of the top young pastry chefs in the nation. Besides being our sweets guru, Stella is the author of the forthcoming Brave Tart book, which will be published in 2017. Welcome to Special Sauce, Stella Parks.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, it's great to have anyone with the lilt in your accent that we can have. This is the first time we've ever had a real Southerner, a Kentuckian.
Hey, y'all.
So tell us about life at the Parks family table in Kentucky.
It's a lot of pie right now. It's a lot of pie.
I mean growing up.
Oh, growing up. It was a lot of pie then, too, actually. And mostly that I made. I've been baking since I was little. It was kind of an activity to do when the babysitter was in. I would get a couple boxes of cake mix.
So who was the cook in the family? Who made dinner?
My parents split it pretty evenly. My mom had her special dishes, chicken pot pie and, you know, pot roast and kind of all the classics. And my dad could, you know, cook up some biscuits and gravy and pretty much anything. And gumbo. Guy's famous for gumbo.
And how's his gumbo?
It's really good. Although he taught my husband to make it, and he might be the better gumbo maker.
Uh-oh.
I don't know.
Oh, are we making news?
Is this being recorded?
Yes, this is definitely being recorded.
Yeah, we should definitely delete that part.
So how did you get interested in pastry?
It was just like a fun activity when I was growing up, just to, if I wanted sweets, just something to make with my mom, you know, slice and bake cookies from Pillsbury, things like that. And it just seemed like a good way to live. I think that was something that my parents had me ask a lot when I was little, not just like, follow your dreams, do whatever you want, but what can you actually see yourself doing for the rest of your life? And, you know, when you think about baking cakes for the rest of your life, that's not really a bad setup. So I was kind of all in from a pretty early age, and went to culinary school straight out of high school.
I read that you got a scholarship, one of the few scholarships to the CIA.
I did. It was their year 2000, celebrate the year of the restaurant with the National Restaurant Association. And they gave away just 5 scholarships that year. And previous to that, I don't know if their policy has changed, but they haven't given away a lot of scholarships historically, or at least on that scale. So I was very fortunate to have been applying for school in that year and to have made a video that they approved of and impressed them. Although I can thank my brother for that. He recorded that little video that we made together when we were
and
just
so you
kids.
Won a full ride to the Culinary Institute of America.
It was, I think it was half. It was covered half my tuition. Yeah.
And so you gravitated towards baking there?
Right away. I have no interest in dead animals or, to eat them, yes, but to actually deal with, you know, meat products and stocks and things like that. Just not interested. So pretty straight away I knew it was just chocolate and sugar.
And how did your thinking evolve as a pastry chef? Because you're really thoughtful and you have a very unique take. Were there particular inspirations?
Early on, I was extremely into the classics. I wanted to just, you know, shun everything that I had grown up with and fully embrace French desserts and technique all around. And it actually wasn't until I was living in Japan in 2004.
Wait, whoa. How did you get from Kentucky to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park in New York to Japan.
It was, I say it, it was my quarter-life crisis. At that point, I had been, I graduated 2 years before that and just working mad hours in the restaurant industry.
In Lexington.
In Lexington. You know, 60, 70-hour weeks and just in a kitchen all the time. And just, you know, saving my money up and putting my head down and working really hard. And after 2 years, I was just so burned out. It was just a lot. I mean, and I've been in the restaurant industry since I was 14, so it wasn't like this was my first ever job in a kitchen and I couldn't take the heat or something. It was just that at that point, I'd actually been in restaurants for 10 years in some capacity. And so I was just wanting a change of pace a little bit. And I found there was a Japanese school in Tokyo that was accepting enrollment. So I didn't do the go abroad and teach English. I went abroad to learn Japanese.
So you went to a Japanese, an intensive Japanese language
school. Yeah,
I was in
class 40 hours a week, plus like after school projects and things like that.
Just on a whim, just to further your education.
Yeah, I guess. I have it on my blog that, you know, some people have a fling or buy a Porsche, and I learned a second language. So I feel like as far as like, you know, quarter life crises go, that came out pretty well. While I was abroad in Japan, I was, you know, just a little homesick. I made a lot of friends there.
Even though there was nobody, you said not even the teachers spoke English.
Yeah, my friends were all students at the school who were Korean, predominantly. And so we just kind of bonded through our light smattering of Japanese. And then as the language grew, our friendships could grow also. It was really fun. I was just constantly surrounded by really amazing people. But just get a little homesick for food, especially. Just missing a taste of something that wasn't, something that was perhaps butter and sugar, just a cookie or something. And I was in the grocery store and I spotted a pack of Oreos. And it was just like this flash of blue in the corner of my eye. It was just so familiar, that like specific Oreo blue of the package. And I was like so excited. And I bought it and I was eating it. And I just remember thinking that cookie tasted better than any crepe or any Napoleon or any croissant that I'd ever had. And it made me realize how many American desserts we don't really appreciate because they're from a factory. You know, we like look down on them. Oh, it's a Reese's Cup. Oh, it's Snickers or something. Yeah, exactly. And that we don't really honor them as like part of our culture. We're like ashamed of them, right? Like this is like corporations taking over America, and we don't have, you know, hand-me-down recipes. We have candy bars at the grocery store. And it just made me realize that those items are actually a really valid part of all of our experience growing up.
And a valid part of the culture.
Yeah, exactly. So that just, from that point on, I realized like I didn't want to shun that aspect anymore. I realized how important it was to me, and I don't think I'd even realized how important it was to me until that moment. And so basically from then on, my desserts were really strongly influenced by like American brand-made desserts like that, like incorporating homemade Oreos or homemade Pop-Tarts, and not turnovers, not like, this is a pastry that I'm going to call a Pop-Tart, but like truly recreating a Pop-Tart.
You were embracing American sweets.
For what it was, and not something that needed to be disguised or dressed up or merely the inspiration, but to truly honor those desserts.
And so was it a matter of you reading Maida Heater or Marion Cunningham or James Beard or any of those people?
No, Betty Crocker and Duncan Hines were probably the larger culinary influence in my life growing up as a child. And then in culinary school, you become a little bit ashamed of that, you know, when everyone else is talking about, oh, you know, reading M.F.K. Fisher was just such an experience for me. And you're like, who, what? So I had always been kind of ashamed of not having that background. And then at a certain point, I was just like, you know what? That's not my background. And just embracing what I did actually grow up with and appreciate.
And so you went to Japan. First of all, it's an incredibly gutsy thing to do. I know you call it your quarter-life crisis, but you didn't know a soul.
No.
You didn't speak a word of Japanese.
Not really, no.
And yet what turned you on was just not just learning the language. It was also spotting the Oreos in the grocery store in Japan.
Yeah.
So we're doing a sort of loop-de-loop here, culturally speaking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that was part of my, you know, wanting to learn Japanese and go abroad was I did know that they had a very strong pastry tradition and that the bakeries in Japan were second to none. So I think ultimately my goal was to kind of insinuate my way into a kitchen somehow. And of course, I'm still here in America, so obviously that didn't happen, but it was a really valuable time for just kind of appreciating what I had overlooked at home.
And so you came back to Lexington and went back to work in the restaurant business in Lexington.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started your blog. Like, what was the inspiration for the blog?
A friend of my husband's, a friend of mine now, Roscoe Weber, worked with my husband actually at a recording studio that my husband owned. And he was a photographer in a previous life, so to speak. And he just hadn't really been shooting anything creatively that he'd wanted to do. And he knew that I was baking and doing things like that. And he was like, you know, I'd really like to get into food photography. He'd done it before at an agency and, you know, was familiar with the setup of what food photography involved, but just hadn't done it in a while. And he's like, well, you know, next time you make something tasty looking, let me know and I'll come over and take a picture. And I was just like, that's like every day of my life. So just stop by whenever. So we started meeting up like once a week to kind of shoot a dessert or do something fun. And then seeing the pictures that he took was hugely inspirational to me because I only ever saw my desserts, you know, for just this brief moment on a plate, and I would see how they looked to me and then they were taken away, but I'd never seen them styled and lit and actually presented in a like a fun and playful way. And so seeing that was really inspirational to me to write about it, because previous to that I didn't really want to write a blog. I was like, I'll let you take these pictures and you can do that if you want to, but I was just kind of being a good sport. I didn't have a lot of personal
investment.
But you're
a great writer.
Well, thank you. So yeah, but seeing those desserts then made me want to talk about them. Like, oh, this is the technique you can do to make a free-form banana pudding or, you know, something like that. And really made it interesting for me to want to talk about the desserts.
And one of the things I noticed on the blog and certainly on your posts on Serious Eats is that you have a sort of Kenji-esque, geeky approach to things.
Yeah.
And where does that come from?
I guess
I mean,
just
Kenji
being a
went
geek.
To MIT and his father was a famous microbiology professor. You don't have that same lineage.
No, I mean, I grew up with a huge crush on Geordie LaForge. So I think
Geordie LaForge?
The chief engineer of the USS Enterprise in CC-1701D, Ed. Gosh.
I had no idea.
So I had this like, you know, science is cool. You can fly a spaceship if you get science. So I think I just liked nerdy things like that, I guess.
And you've incorporated them into your baking and your writing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually, in some ways, a Kenji influence on me. Because, you know, him embracing science so intensely in his own writing is kind of a good affirmation that I can do that also, because I think previous to that, you don't see a lot of science in baking, like doubling down, like really digging into like, you know, what percent tapioca starch do you need in ratio to whole fruit to make a gel, you know, like that kind of thing. And so seeing, you know, Kenji nerd out on something was kind of inspirational to be like, yeah, just because no one's doing it doesn't mean you can't, or just because it's not the most common way desserts are presented doesn't mean you can't. And so I think I've definitely delved deeper into that because of his influence.
Yeah, I mean, what are some of the favorite posts you've written for Serious Eats?
Cherry pie that? Is right up there right now. I'm on a big pie jag, so.
Thank the Lord she's on a pie jag. That's
everyone's
all I could
so
say.
Sick at the office today. They're like, please stop.
But you make the best pie ever.
Thank you.
I'm not saying that because you're sitting across from me. This is a totally objective opinion. I've written books on food. I know, you know, you could trust me. But your pie crust is unbelievable.
Well, thank you.
And we have been eating them all
There's
week.
There's been a lot of pie. There's been a lot of pie
but there,
this week.
But there was that sugar post.
Oh, yeah, the roasted sugar. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so talk to people about roasted sugar. First of all, who roasts sugar?
Well, I do. Other than that, I don't know. I'm sure, I mean, someone has to be doing it. It's not that hard. Put sugar in the oven. Like, that's not really a technique. But if you put sugar in a low oven for an extended period of time, it develops caramelization without melting or without liquefying. So you get some of those caramel flavors. And if you let it go for a long time, you can get, like, a pretty legit caramel. It'll turn very dark brown, and it will develop a really intense caramel flavor. But if you just let it go a couple hours, it's just an ivory color, and it looks like it's still completely normal sugar, except it's slightly off-white now. But it has an incredibly complex flavor, and it's dramatically less sweet than sugar. And it doesn't it's not simply that it seems less sweet. It is measurably less sweet from a scientific perspective.
Like, so what did you just say, oh, I'm just going to put some sugar in the oven at 275
This was actually a horrible accident. I wish I could say that I had like some type of Kenji level inspiration into the science of it. And I decided I'm going to set me down and do this. But at the restaurant I used to work at in Lexington, it didn't have any heating or air. So in the summers, it was sweltering in the basement kitchen where I worked. And the winters, it was freezing. In the winters, it was about 55 degrees down there. It was, you know, deep in a basement. And, you know, when I'd come in the morning, everything would be so cold. All my bowls, all my pans, all my utensils, the bins of sugar, the bins of flour. And it was to the point that I couldn't effectively even cream butter and sugar because I didn't have a microwave also in this kitchen. So I couldn't have a quick, you know, warm this up. So I could, you know, leave some butter near the oven to let it kind of soften. But even then when I would put in a bowl with all that sugar, which had been chilled down to 55 degrees, cause that's how cold it was in the kitchen, it wouldn't cream. It was just too cold. And I would get a blowtorch and try and warm the KitchenAid bowl. And that just wasn't effective for a long-term solution. So what I would do is I would fill a sheet pan with sugar and put it in an oven at like, you know, just the pilot light on or just like at 100 degrees.
Just as a way to solve the problem.
Just to knock off the chill. And honestly, I was just warming it up to 70 degrees. I wasn't trying to like warm it specifically. And I also had to write all the checks and receive all the invoices and do a lot of, you know, restaurant chores that you do. And there was just one day where it got away from me. There was just so many other things going on. I think someone hadn't come in that day. So I was like fielding more calls than I had to normally and writing more checks than I had to normally. Just crazy. And suddenly I could just smell caramel. And then I remember the sugar was still in the oven, and I thought for sure, I was like 1 second away from realizing I was burning the restaurant down because I was upstairs when I smelled it. And I thought, if the smell of caramel is reaching me upstairs, the sugar must have melted in the pan eventually from the heat. It must have bubbled over. It's on the bottom of the oven and like a smoking volcano of doom. It's probably lit on fire. It's combustible. Like, so I ran downstairs at 1,000 miles an hour and opened the oven door. And inside was this perfectly innocuous looking tray of sugar. Like, just sugar. It wasn't brown. It wasn't melted. It wasn't even, it smelled so intensely of caramel. And so I pulled it out, and it wasn't until I pulled it out and could see it in the actual light as opposed to, like, the, you know, the dingy oven light that makes everything look kind of gross. I pulled it out, and I could see that it wasn't, like, snow white anymore like sugar should be, that it was kind of, like, an ecru beige kind of color. And I was like, what the hell is going on? And I tasted some of it, and it was just unbelievably delicious. I mean, it tasted like sugar. It was sweet like sugar, but it wasn't too sweet. It was almost like raw sugar, like where it's got that complexity to it. There was like more dimensions of flavor and less sweetness and a lot more richness. So the first thing I did was bake an angel food cake because I wanted to see how it would behave in a fussy recipe. I didn't want to like make ice cream, which would probably do fine no matter what. I wanted to see how it behaved in a recipe that depended on sugar for structure. And it baked up the best angel food cake I'd ever made in my life, and I was just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So that's how I discovered toasting sugar.
And so now, have you tried toasting sugar for every recipe, or does it really need?
Yeah, I do it in a lot of things. It's a really good way to tame the sweetness of things that are traditionally too sweet. Like angel food cake is a dessert that's kind of inescapably sweet, or fudge. You know, a lot of people have a problem with the excessive.
I hate fudge. It's too sweet.
Fudge can be so good. So yeah, you can use that in fudge or jams and jellies and preserves. Pie, it's in my pie. Yeah. Some things it's a waste. Like if you put it in a chocolate cake, unless that you perceive that cake as being too sweet to begin with, it's not really going to do a lot there. So that would be kind of a wasted application. Or you could make caramel with it, but that would also be a wasted. You know, you just spent like 3 to 4 hours roasting the sugar and then just go ahead and make caramel with it doesn't really make a lot
right.
of sense.
But I mean, it's so interesting because it has far reaching implications for pastry making.
Yeah, actually, the scientists.
And it was an accident.
Yeah, there are scientists who have researched this phenomenon that I discovered. Actually, I have a chapter in my book on toasted sugar, and I was trying to write the introduction and explain what was going on and explain that it tasted less sweet. And I was like, I wonder if it actually is less sweet, if there's any like measurable difference. And so I started researching online, and that's when I found that scientists had also discovered this phenomenon simultaneously. So it wasn't like my breakthrough per se. Other people had already researched this. But the scientists who led this study found that, you know, it was less sweet and it's actually less caloric than regular sugar, and it has a lower glycemic index. I mean, not significantly. This is not like suddenly it's diabetic friendly. Not like that, but just like subtly lower. And they said in an interview, the woman who led the study said that she hoped it would have like widespread implications for the manufacturing industry, that you could make, you know, snack foods that were like naturally lower in calories without having to like resort to, you know, chemical substitutes or, you know, I mean, not that I have a problem with chemicals, but just that you could, with something that's easy, you already have, that you could produce in-house from a manufacturing standpoint. I haven't really seen anybody pick up on that, but
yeah.
But next thing you know, I'm going to be like selling artisanal sugar down at the farmer's market.
To me, this is
hand-roasted.
Like, this is mad genius material that, you know, is deserving of a MacArthur Award.
Well, you just point them over to me and we'll...
All right. We'll see what I'll see what I can do. So what's the big difference between the life you had making desserts at a restaurant and now being a writer and developing recipes for Serious Eats?
Oh, man. It has been a huge education for me because when you're in a restaurant, it doesn't matter how annoying something is. It's your job to do it a certain way. So, I don't know, like making a painstaking puff pastry or something, you know, like... I'm going to laminate the dough. This is what I do. It doesn't matter that it takes a long time. It doesn't matter that, you know, whatever.
You can't ask any questions.
Yeah, it's fine. You don't have to worry about it. And then I would post some of these recipes to my blog sometimes, and people would be like, wow, this is a lot of work. And I didn't care. I was like, yeah, it's a lot of work to make desserts. Like, that's not my problem. And then kind of like shifting gears, instead of just being, I'm sharing recipes that are for a pastry chef from a pastry chef, and realizing, no, like I'm specifically making recipes that I want people to make at home, and just realizing how annoying some things are. And it's like, gosh, Stella, you're so annoying. Like, why would you call for 9 ounces of chocolate in a recipe? And like, I did, because I would buy 10 kilo blocks of chocolate or whatever. I didn't care. I'd use exactly how many ounces I wanted to. And then when you realize someone's buying that retail, they're probably buying it in 8 ounce chunks. And so calling for 9 ounces means they have to buy two. And it's like, wow, okay, but could you just like shave off an ounce of chocolate and save someone that extra package and that would be fine? Or just like steps that you would do in a restaurant that you don't care, you've got all day. Go ahead and let this proof for 8 hours, like just a little bit of yeast in a long time and it'll fit your schedule. And then realizing like we could probably speed that up without a huge loss of quality for, you know, for the right thing. Obviously for an artisanal bread, you don't want to like rush that process, but just, you know, for something low key, like if you're just making like a basic white loaf, you don't have to, you know, go that far. So a lot of it has been me realizing what the conditions are people cook at home with, mm-hmm. and learning to adapt to that and cooking at home more, baking at home more often myself, which I never did before.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's sort of democratized your thinking in
a way. I think it really has. Yeah. Because suddenly it's... you know, realizing maybe not everybody has a food processor, so I don't want to like base too many of my techniques on that. And if I call for a food processor in one of my recipes, especially in my cookbook, it's going to be because it's the best way to do something, or perhaps the only way to do something. But otherwise, I'd rather just have, you know, bust out a knife or, you know, try and do it in a stand mixer or with a hand mixer. Yeah, and kind of like not leaning on specialty equipment too hard if I can avoid it.
Yeah, yeah. So, for someone who wants to be a pastry chef, they think they love to make desserts at home, because you hear this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love making desserts.
Mm-hmm.
Someone told me I should do it for a living.
Don't do it for a living.
Why do you say that?
It's a lot of work. And I mean, it's a lifestyle also. It's not just like it's a 9-to-5 job. We were talking about this in the cab on the way over here, that I had never had a lunch break in my entire life. I've been working in, you know, restaurants since I was a little kid. We'd have family meal, but that's not exactly a lunch break. And just like realizing like people stop what they're doing and they eat. It has nothing to do with their job. That's weird. And so it's like, you know, in a restaurant, you're working all day and you're working long hours and weird hours. And it's not about you, and you're not anybody's hero. Someone's mad at you and writing nasty Yelp reviews about you. And there's a lot that goes to it that I think people don't like take into account. But anybody who wants to get into the restaurant industry, I would strongly recommend working for a year somewhere. And some people say like, well, I wouldn't have an education. How would I get a job? It's like, if you think walking out of culinary school is a guaranteed job somewhere, better think again. So I think it's good to have that experience. Like I said, I'd worked in a restaurant for 4 years by the time I graduated high school, and back of the house work. So I knew what I was getting into.
You started at 13?
I started at 14.
Wasn't that a violation of child labor laws in
Kentucky? I looked it up, and as long as I worked under, I think it was like 20 hours a week, I could work. There was like just the regulations in Kentucky. I guess we like to put kids to work in Kentucky. but it was like a family friend in the restaurant, and I asked them if I could have a job, and they're like, no, Precious, you're too young. And then my dad's a lawyer. I was like, let's look into this. I think that can't possibly be true. So then we found out that I could actually legally have a job. And so we like printed out like the statute or whatever and took it to them. And they're just like, okay, I guess we'll hire you. And so, I mean, I'm sure I was terribly underfoot, but, you know, just like chopping green onions in the kitchen or whatever. I worked in the dish pit. I did everything. So
after school and on weekends?
On weekends predominantly, and then every day in the summer when, you know, as many as my hours would allow at that age. So all the way until I graduated high school at 18, and that's when I went to culinary school. So, you know,
yeah,
it was definitely a huge part of my high school experience.
So what inspires you? You know, you're just daydreaming at home, and how does something come into your brain?
I think actually the readers have a lot to do with it now that I'm at Serious Eats, you know, people asking questions and the commenting. You know, I just did this post on cherry pie, and then I had discovered during this process that stoneware pie plates are kind of rubbish. And so I was like, you know, if you can use tempered glass because it conducts heat more effectively and it makes the crust more crisp. And with stoneware, it just the heat translates to the dough so slowly that the butter just kind of melts out and it's kind of greasy and it's not really very good. But those dishes are so pretty, and so many people have a really pretty, you know, beautifully enameled stoneware pie plate. And I'm just like, get rid of those. And then so many people in the comment section were just like, what about aluminum? Like, what about those disposable aluminum pans? I'm like, oh, gosh, like, I don't know. Like, why would I buy a disposable pan? Like, just because I have a handful of, like, cheap glass pans, and I give away enough desserts that I'm used to, like, that shuffle, you know, like, okay, I gave away two pie plates, but I've got two now, and those two will come back next week. And like, it was never a problem for me, but obviously if you don't bake a lot and that's like your one pie plate, you don't want to like give it away. So kind of realizing the perspective of like normal people, like who don't have like 37 pie plates to like spare. Like, okay, so just this last week we did tests with aluminum pie pans. And it was fantastic. Like, I wouldn't have ever thought to test it out myself, except that people were asking, like, what happens? And so it's a really cool chance to like explore maybe areas I wouldn't have thought to explore on my own.
And the book is really all about iconic American desserts,
yeah.
Sort of homemade versions of of devil dogs or peanut butter cups.
Yeah,
or
it's everything. It's like everything is given equal weight. So like, you know, red velvet cake, lemon meringue pie, chocolate chip cookies, just as valid as Snickers and Reese's Cups and Nilla wafers and Oreos. Like, it's all... That whole spectrum is kind of equally weighted in my eyes.
I've never had one of your homemade Snickers.
I
bet it's really good.
We're shooting the photography for the book on the week of the 25th. So if any leftovers survive that shoot, I will be sure to bring them to Series E's HQ.
You're too thin. You don't eat everything that you bake.
No, I don't eat everything that I bake. I eat a lot of it. I'm sure I have the cholesterol of like a 98-year-old trucker.
And what about the photographer? Do they get to eat it?
Yeah, they get to eat it. My neighbors get a lot of desserts. It got to the point last week that I walked out my front door with a pie and handed it to a random stranger. I just like walked out the door and went to my one next door neighbor, and he wasn't home. And I don't actually think he has any idea what I do for a living. He's just like, I guess that girl likes to bake. We've never actually had a conversation. And so anyhow, he wasn't home. And so I was like walking back to my house, and this lady was like walking her dogs. I'm like, do you want a peach pie? And she just looked at me like I was completely crazy. Like, what are you saying?
Fantastic.
And she was just like, okay. And I just kind of point at my house. I'm like, I live there. You can just like bring the plate back whenever. And then my husband, John, said that a couple days later, he was just like, I just met this guy named Robert. And he said, you gave his wife a pie. And I was like, I don't know. Maybe I did.
And wait, did you get a thank you note did John say, wow, the guy said your pie was awesome?
He said the guy said it didn't last long. that's as much as I heard from him.
That's high praise.
Yeah. But
that's high praise. So you actually were quite methodical in the book in terms of let's take an Oreo, let's take, you know, a pecan sandy. Let's mm-hmm. take, and how do I make it as good as it can be mm-hmm. without fancifying it,
mm-hmm.
right? Was that the basic concept?
Yeah, my brother is my guiding light in this because he's got this whole, like, if it's really close but not quite there, it's like buying the knockoff version. Like, you're buying, like, the not Captain Crunch, but, like, Lieutenant Crispy or something. It's like, it's not fully there, but it's okay. He's like, so why would you go to all that effort to make a second best runner-up, you know, Diet Coke version of the real thing? And he's like, but at the same time, if it's too good, if it's, like, so much better than the original that it's not the same anymore, that's not good either. Because, like, if you're like, okay, suddenly the Oreo is now made with, like, you know, Brazilian chocolate and filled with, like, the most luxurious, like, whatever cream, and suddenly it's just not really an Oreo anymore. So it's, like, this fine line between as good as but not too far better than. So you can still, like, have a bite and it's familiar and, like,
that's
nostalgic.
That's threading a needle, though.
It is. I've been working on this book for 5 years now, so I've had time. I've had plenty of time.
You've made a lot of Oreos.
I've made a lot of Oreos.
You've made hundreds, if not
thousands. No, easily thousands. Easily
thousands of Oreos.
No question.
Given to strangers.
Given to strangers, given to my dad. Sometimes comes by our house on the way to work, on his way to work, and he'll pick them up and give them to his, you know, his office and to his friends and other people he knows. I don't know. He's probably given to strangers at this point too, to be honest, because it's just more desserts than anybody can put up with.
And now that you're writing about food and for Serious Eats and for the book, can you imagine doing anything else? Like, do you feel like this is what you were put on this earth to do?
It's my mission. I don't know. I mean, I'm in a very contented place, especially at Serious Eats, because I feel like for me this is coming full circle, because writing for Serious Eats initially years ago was kind of my first, like, dang, I'm doing something. This is cool, you know, because previously it was, you know, just kind of me doing my thing in Lexington and nobody really knew or cared. And then
I know when I called you up, you were like, who is this?
Like, why are you calling me? And so it was kind of, it was really cool to start writing for Serious Eats and then have, I guess, the kind of legitimacy that goes with that. And the people were, like, suddenly, like, paying attention to what I had to say, which is very interesting. And so now coming back and being full time at Serious Eats just for me feels like this full circle process, and I'm very content being here. So I can't, I don't think I would go back to the restaurant industry at this point. I think I'm really comfortable in the food writing, recipe developing stage.
You have tremendous intellectual curiosity, and writing the way you write and taking the approach that you take, you get to scratch that curiosity itch.
Yeah. It's really fun to be able to explore in that way and to just take a deep dive and be like, I'm just going to bake 37 pies in the next 2 days and see what happens when you do A, B, and C, or if you increase the sugar by 10%.
What happens is I gain 5 pounds. That's what happens. That's one of the first things that happens.
I have nothing to do with this.
So now it's time for the special sauce, all you can answer buffet.
Oh, gosh.
Don't get scared.
Okay.
You don't have
I'm
a clock.
Scared.
It's not like Jeopardy, you know.
Is there a buzzer?
There's no buzzer.
Okay.
I mean, I could, if you want me to buzz, I can buzz. So what's in your desert island fridge?
A lot of butter, some cream, eggs. How big is the fridge?
Big, big. Big. It's a big fridge.
Okay, a side of beef because I got to eat. Probably.
Would you like it broken down?
I mean, I have something to do. I'm on a desert island, right? I'm kind of
so you'll
trapped.
Figure out how to break it down.
Although maybe like my cutting board space is limited, so sure, let's have it broken down.
Okay.
Probably a lot of vegetables. I do love some vegetables. A lot of green vegetables. More butter.
More butter.
Milk. Milk is definitely in there. And probably a lot of fruit.
A lot of fruit.
A lot of fruit. Got to make pies. Do I have an oven on this desert island? That, wait,
yeah,
that changes everything. Because if I don't have an oven, then the butter is not doing
any good.
No,
you have
an
oven.
Okay.
You have an oven.
Okay.
This is a really well-equipped desert island.
I mean, honestly, just the basics. I'm not a fussy girl. I don't need some kind of, you know, like...
Isn't chocolate one of your basics? Not so much?
I I guess I get cocoa powder. If I was on desert island, I'd try and embrace, you know, where I'm at and use cocoa powder instead of trying to fight the heat with the chocolate, because it would always be a battle. It'd be a losing battle.
And are you one of those people that believes that you can make just as good a chocolate dessert, like a chocolate ice cream, with cocoa powder as you can with chocolate?
I always use both. It doesn't matter what. If it's ice cream, I use both. If it's brownies, I use both. If it's cake, I use both. Always both.
And talk a little bit about that, because that's a big controversy. Because if you look at most ingredient lists, yeah, for example, in commercial chocolate ice cream, you just see cocoa powder.
Yeah. Well, for chocolate ice cream, it can be really tricky to get a lot of actual chocolate in there, because the cocoa butter wants to freeze pretty hard. So it's kind of a fine line to walk between sugar and other types of ingredients that are going to like depress the freezing point. But if you can get both, it's just like a more well-rounded flavor and it has a nice mouthfeel, I think. So
would there be ice cream if there was a freezer?
Yeah, there would be a lot of ice cream. There would be a lot of ice cream.
Flavors?
All the flavors. Okay, mint chocolate chip, because it's a desert island, so I need something kind of refreshing.
Okay.
What else? Probably coconut. Coconut would be really nice on a desert island. That would be good. Strawberry.
Yeah, coconuts, you know, the good thing is that you're surrounded by coconut trees.
I wouldn't have to waste one of my, like, food slots of my request line. I could just shimmy up there and get some for myself.
Exactly. So coconut, mint chocolate chip, coconut's local.
Yeah, local coconut, for sure.
You know, and you can advertise as for your mail order ice cream business that it's local coconut.
Yeah, I would definitely do that. There'd probably be like some kind of citrus, like maybe like a key lime ice cream with some like graham cracker chunks in there. Like that would be good.
All right.
Of that.
This sounds good. I'd come.
Yeah.
I'd come visit you.
I need an ice cream machine, Ed.
You need an ice cream machine?
I don't have one.
All right.
We don't have one at the office.
All right. Done.
Okay.
Done.
Summer ice cream, here we come.
Summer ice cream, here we come. So who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Could be living, dead.
But no family allowed?
Could be TV characters, could be...
Oh, TV characters.
Yeah.
Captain Picard.
Captain Picard.
Done.
Okay,
I can have more people?
Yeah, you can have five people.
Okay, so five people. Oh. Okay, Captain Picard, Gaius Baltar...
Wait, you have to tell us what shows and what, because, you know, I
don't
ignorant.
Have to explain Captain Picard, do I? That's pretty.
You might.
From Star Trek The Next Generation.
Okay.
He's the captain of the Enterprise.
Okay.
Captain Picard would be there. Gaius Baltar would be there.
And who's he?
He's from Battlestar Galactica.
Okay.
Mr. Rogers would be there. I feel like I would need some of that soothing presence in my life.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, you're on a desert island. You could get anxious.
Yeah, and who else? I'm down to my final two. I feel like I'm not spending them wisely.
No, I think you're spending them brilliantly.
Who else would I have? It would probably be someone from a video game.
That's good.
To be honest.
You and your husband play a lot of video
games.
We
play a lot of video games. Get Zelda. Why not? Like
Zelda from?
Zelda. Zelda from Zelda.
Zelda from Zelda. You could see that I'm not a video game person.
Because she could probably, you know, help me understand some of the finer points of the Hyrule mythology that haven't been perfectly spelled out for us in the game.
All right.
That would be helpful.
Okay.
And I would get Blaze from Streets of Rage 2.
this is an all video game and television.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
that's okay.
If it's my last day on the earth, I don't, you know, there's no need for history at that point. I don't have anything to reflect on. I'm just getting ready to go out. You know, because she fought an entire city of crime to avenge her murdered partner. So I feel like that's really important.
Yeah. So she's paying it forward.
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, she might give me some courage to face the darkness ahead.
All right. That's good. So what are you eating?
Well, I'm going to eat some donuts as soon as we get it here. I'm excited about those donuts.
Yeah.
The hibiscus donut, and what was the other one? Dulce de leche.
Right.
But what else am I eating?
You're going to eat some steak from that beef.
Oh, yeah. Oh, on my desert. We're still talking about my desert island food. Oh, for our last meal.
Yeah.
Gosh. For our last
meal. Could be anything.
For our last meal.
Pork buns.
It's probably just fried chicken, to be honest.
I have to say, I'm with you.
Just, you know, fried
chicken. Doesn't get any better. My guess is, and I think I've tasted your biscuits, you probably make phenomenal biscuits.
I do. I don't eat biscuits with my fried chicken, though, strangely enough.
Really?
I just eat fried chicken with my fried chicken.
You just have fried chicken straight up, no vegetables.
I might have macaroni and cheese also.
All right. I like this. This is a really, really promising. Now I want to be the only non-video game, non-actor character at the dinner.
We'll make room for it.
All right. That's good. And what's for dessert?
What's for dessert? Oh, gosh. It's my last meal. I'm filled up on fried chicken. You know, at this point, it'd probably be pie.
Pie.
Oh, like a blueberry pie.
This is just warming the cockles of my
heart. Especially if we had that coconut ice cream was still around, because coconut ice cream and blueberries sounds like it'd be a pretty good combo.
So fried chicken,
blueberry
pie, and coconut ice cream made from local coconuts.
Yeah.
I like this.
The most ill-conceived final meal of anyone's life, just now made up.
So what's your guilty pleasure?
All of them?
I mean, which one is it?
I don't know. I'm honestly not very good at, like, denial of any variety, so I just, you know,
I know.
I don't have a lot of shame
Since you became obsessed by Oreos.
Yeah, I'm like, I just ate a sleeve of Oreos. Who has a problem with that? And that, so, I mean, like, I don't feel guilty about it, so I guess it's not a guilty pleasure.
There's no such thing as a guilty pleasure.
I mean, I know I should feel guilty or I should be ashamed, but, like, Fruity Pebbles are incredibly delicious. Like, not as a dessert item, not as a garnish, not, like, mixed into anything. Just, like, a bowl of Fruity Pebbles is beautiful. and I know I'm not supposed to say that, but I'm going to say it.
That's good. So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Oh, I don't cook. I'm a terrible cook.
You're just a great pastry chef.
Yeah, that's it.
So John cooks?
John cooks.
So what would John cook in the house if there's nothing to eat?
If there's nothing to eat, John likes to grill. He likes to make tacos. He likes to make Turkish food. He's obsessed with Turkish food.
But yeah, you'd have to prepare to have Turkish food.
I mean, I guess. Oh, when there's nothing in the house. When there's nothing.
So, like scrambled eggs.
Like a carbonara, probably. Oh, we always make oyakodon. You don't need much to make that.
What is it?
Oyakodon.
What's oyakodon?
It's like, it means parent and child. It's chicken and egg over rice. It's a Japanese dish. And so, I mean, all you need is some, like, leftover chicken. Ideally, you're not, like, poaching a chicken fresh for this. Like, some leftover chicken and an egg. And then, you know, like, a Japanese stock is just dashi. So you probably have some fish flakes in the pantry or, you know, whatever. So it's pretty easy to make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. So if you could have lunch.
Lunch.
With one person.
One person.
That you just like to spend a couple of hours picking their brain and finding out what makes him or her tick.
Mm-hmm.
Who would it be?
Well, so this is such my still discluded family. Or I have to still discluded family. Well, that's a really good question. Actually, I'd probably sit down with Kenji because he's in San Francisco. Like, we never actually get to, like, really talk things out. Like, we email a lot and work a lot, but it'd be great to, like, actually, you know, hang out with him and probably hang out in the kitchen and do some stuff.
And he has as many obsessions as you do when it comes to pop culture.
And yeah, we could totally nerd out about, you know, whatever and cook some dinner and maybe like John and Audrey would have drinks or something. I don't know.
John is your husband. Mm-hmm. Audrey is his wife. Well, thank you so much, Stella Parks, for sharing your special sauce with us. It's been awesome.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read Stella's brilliant posts on Serious Eats, and you can join the rest of us in waiting for Stella's book, Brave Tart, to be published. So long, Serious Eaters.
That was super relaxed. That was just hanging out with Ed time.